The Texas connection in the impeachment inquiry, how two figures from the Lone Star State factor into tomorrow's hearings on Capitol Hill. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Is the doctor shortage a phony crisis? A new Texas Medical Center survey points to some big cracks in the conventional wisdom. Bok wars break out in Shiner, Texas. We'll hear about the three billboards fermenting anger among some locals. And what Ted Cruz and Kim Kardashian have in common and what that could mean for the fate of a death row inmate. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 12th day of November 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Cold enough for you? Our listeners up in the panhandle may be chuckling at some of us in North Central and South Texas right now, delaying school openings as we reacclimate to the realities of life at 32 and below. Stay warm and safe, y'all, and get ready for some fireworks tomorrow. Or will it be? Fireworks, that is. Let's pull back for just a moment and try to recall the white-hot intensity of anger directed at the Trump administration for collaborating with Russia in hijacking the 2016 election. That was the narrative, remember? Just you wait, said opponents of the president. The independent counsel's investigation promised to be a blockbuster, the likes of which the Republic had never seen. In the eyes of many, the mighty wheels of justice were rolling. And yet, as the nation watched Robert Mueller testify before Congress on July 24, 2019, over the course of 7 hours, one could almost feel the air hissing out of the tires. Witch hunt, the president said. Here we are, almost 4 months later. Raise your hands if you thought we'd be at the precipice of public presidential impeachment hearings tomorrow, not because of Russia, but because of a scandal involving Ukraine. I don't see many hands going up. Here to help us understand the spectacle that's about to begin and its notable Texas connection, James Riddlesberger, a political science professor at Texas Christian University. Professor Riddlesberger, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be here.
Public hearings in the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry targeting President Donald Trump are just about to get underway, and two Texans seem to be rather deeply involved. Let's begin with Republican Governor Rick Perry, I suppose we should say, one of the longest-serving cabinet members in the Trump administration, outgoing Energy Secretary Perry. How is he tied up in this?
Well, he's tied up in this because he was the one who developed the relationship with President Zelensky in Ukraine, and he did so for some legitimate reasons, which is that he was involved in trying to promote American energy in Ukraine, which is part of his job. Where it becomes a little dicey is that he became part of that triumvirate, the three amigos they're talking about, who were working with Giuliani and doing kind of backdoor politics with Zelensky and Ukrainian government. He, of course, denies that he had anything to do with the quid pro quo that people have been talking about, and that he never heard Joe or Hunter Biden's names even mentioned. I think there's a lot yet to learn about his role in this, but to date, his explanation is that all he was trying to do was promote American energy policy.
Let's just be clear, a few things there. Giuliani is Rudy Giuliani. He is the president's personal attorney, and he has maintained the president's innocence, of course, throughout this. Secretary Perry, I still want to say Governor Perry. Secretary Perry, though, was actually tasked to go to Ukraine, and the notion, at least among some, has been that the president himself might be traveling to Ukraine if, in fact, the Ukrainian president-elect had agreed to open up an investigation into one of the president's political rivals, correct?
That is all correct. But the problem is that we haven't heard from Perry himself.
And he's refusing to testify, or at least has refused
to testify. And so what his role in this is, we know what part of his role was. We know that he did, in fact, have communications with Zelensky. We know that he attended Zelensky's inauguration. All of that's part of the public record. What we don't know is how deeply involved he was, although there are indications that he was involved in conversations for months with Ukrainian politicians. politicians. But I think that what we don't know is actually more than what we do know at this point.
Let me ask you about the involvement of another Texan, former Republican Congressman Pete Sessions. How is he wrapped up in this?
Well, he's wrapped up in this because he had a relationship with the two Ukrainian or former Soviet affiliates of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. And they gave a modest contribution to his campaign, a little over $5,000, which is not certainly an unusual amount of money for a campaign contribution. But of course, because they are wrapped up in this, it starts to look that way. Subsequent to his conversations with them, Pete Sessions recommended the firing of Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch of the Ukraine. And he says that he did so because she was speaking ill of President Trump. But it's very unusual for a member of Congress to get involved in policy making at that level.
I mentioned earlier the Mueller investigation, and my reference to the air going out of the tires was not that there wasn't anything substantial there. It was just that people didn't seem to latch on to the allegations that were unearthed. Question here, this is a rather complicated story. If you're trying to follow things tomorrow, what are you looking for?
You know, the term that is used has been used so far as quid pro quo, but it really has to do with the two central points in the impeachment provision in the Constitution, and that is having to do with bribery and treason. Is, in fact, this a element of bribery? Did the president try to bribe with the withholding of those funds? Did he try to bribe the Ukrainians to investigate his political opponents? And that is going to be, I think, the central point of this investigation moving forward. We see the Democrats moving away from quid pro quo, which is a term that is most Americans don't use and are not familiar with, but they're very familiar with the notion of bribery.
James Riddlesberger is a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Professor Riddlesberger, thanks again.
Delighted to be here, as always.
Hey, a little later in the broadcast, we're going to be exploring a crack in some long-accepted conventional wisdom about the state of healthcare, but this much seems quite clear indeed. Texas has the highest uninsured rate in the country, and you'd be hard-pressed to find any new policies aimed at changing that. But some activists are hoping to anyway, and they have their sights set on November 2020 for starters. Ashley Lopez of KUT Austin explains.
A group of about 20 people are standing around on a chilly Saturday morning in southeast Austin, preparing to knock on some doors. Shane Johnson, who is part of a left-leaning group called Indivisible Austin, reminds the group why they're there.
So 5 million Texans are uninsured. That's mind-boggling. Is this right? Is this okay?
No.
Do you, wait, I didn't hear any emotion. No, it's not okay.
This event was one of seven across the state aimed at organizing people around one issue, Texas's high uninsured rate. That includes the highest rate among children and women of childbearing age. And all these metrics have been getting worse. Yet in the past few legislative sessions, state lawmakers have done nothing to improve the rate. For one, Texas is among a minority of states that has refused to expand Medicaid to more low-income people through the Affordable Care Act. And earlier this year, lawmakers failed to take steps to make sure children kept their coverage. That's even though advocates like Laura Garrick-Hardis with the Children's Defense Fund of Texas have been urging the legislature to take health care coverage seriously.
Advocacy organizations really feel like enough is enough. And if the legislature won't listen to us, then our new audience is going to be Texans, everyday Texans.
Along with the Texas Organizing Project and the Center for Public Policy Priorities, Garrick-Hardis's group launched an issues-based nonpartisan campaign. The point is to knock on doors and talk to people about the state's coverage crisis and also collect their stories about what it's like to be uninsured. Garrick-Hardis says block walking is just the beginning.
This is going to be year-round organizing, and our very next step is to take the stories that we're hearing today to our policymakers and 2020 state candidates.
Mimi Garcia and Becky Bullard were among those advocates collecting stories this past weekend, including the story of Nina Torres.
You know, do you have health insurance or health coverage?
I actually don't, and the reason why I don't is because I opened up my own business.
Torres says she's having a hard time getting coverage through her husband's employer now that she's working for herself. Garcia and Bullard suggested she look into the Obamacare marketplace, although even if she signs up immediately, that coverage won't kick in until January. In the meantime, Torres says not having coverage has been pretty stressful. She says even if she feels really sick, she tries to avoid going to the hospital or a doctor.
I wait till the very last minute unless I absolutely need to go.
And there are a lot of stories like this in Texas. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, last year, almost 18% of Texans were uninsured. That's better than it was before Obamacare became law. But under the Trump administration, that rate has climbed each year. Laura Garicardis says even with that trend, it's been hard to get lawmakers to prioritize health insurance coverage.
They have to pay attention to this because us working directly with policymakers, asking them, informing them, providing them the research about the consequences of leaving so many Texans, adults and children uninsured is not working. And so if we're the wrong messengers, then maybe the people of Texas will be the right messengers.
Garicardis says about 100 people signed up to Canvas last weekend during events in San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, Austin, Galveston, McAllen, and Fort Worth. She says they plan to collect as many stories as they can in the hopes lawmakers will start to listen. In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez for the Texas Standard.
So let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about lots of things on social media today, including the story at the top of the show, how public impeachment hearings are set to begin Wednesday. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Janice Hitchcock says, I'd like to see the men who derailed Bill Clinton's presidency over Monica Lewinsky care a tenth as much about a president using congressionally approved military aid to extort an ally while violating the emoluments clause on the daily. Most of us are neither Team Red nor Team Blue, Janice adds. It's past time that these people follow their oath to defend the Constitution. While shifting gears, we're also hearing about that blustery Arctic blast of wind that's brought winter weather to Texas a bit early, or as Tim Bauerkemper calls it on our Facebook page, chilly cooking weather. We also got some nice photos and whatnot from people there on our Facebook page as well. I saw this great snow-dusted photo. I said, oh, shucks, where is that? Turned out it was in Chicago. But folks can still go there and join our Facebook page, and I'll be back with more wintry dispatches from our friends and listeners later in the show.
I'd be interested in your recipes, to be honest. We had cauliflower soup last night.
Ooh,
it was
nice.
Fantastic. Yeah, cold weather recipes. All right. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Tweet us at Texas Standard, and Wells will be looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. Some experimental things happening in higher ed these days, you know, like bringing in movie stars as professors, or as we're about to hear, taking formal instruction out of the lecture hall and into a bar. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, a business model may be blooming, mixing spirits with scholarship.
It's 6:30 on a Tuesday night. Local brews, some cocktails, wine, and food are filling tables in the Cambria Hotel that looks out on Dallas's busy Elm Street. It's lecture time.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Props and Pints.
Peter Schmidt created Props and Pints and welcomes the crowd of self-described geeks and nerds. They're especially into tonight's topic, mosasaurs, giant sea creatures that swam here 72 million years ago.
Mosasaurs are actually one of my favorite dinosaurs.
That's why Shay Lecters paid tonight's $12 fee.
So any chance to speak with someone who has studied paleontology and anything like that, you don't get to run into those kinds of people every day.
The professor in charge tonight, paleontologist Lewis Jacobs. He's with Southern Methodist University and a legitimate world-class mosasaur expert. He's uncovered fossils from Angola to Mongolia and here in North Texas. Jacobs was pleased he drew dozens of fossil fanatics to the bar.
I'm very grateful for being here. I think it's a very clever idea.
The clever idea was launched in 2017. Peter Schmidt had just been laid off from his 21-year job writing for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he wondered, what next?
And I had the insight, what if we went back to literally a Socratic model where people gathered around the scholar as they gathered around Socrates and paid a few bucks to hear what they had to say?
Schmidt figured he had his supply of scholars. There are stars like Jacobs, but also struggling, untenured adjunct professors, some on food stamps. Next, he needed demand. In his hometown of Washington, D.C., the Profs and Pints inaugural lecture was called Science Fiction and Washington. That was 2 years ago. Earlier this year, a lecture on Alexander Hamilton, which used the bounce from the Broadway blockbuster, launched Profs and Pints National Talks. Schmidt says some events have drawn 200 people.
You know, there are a lot of people out there who have interests who don't necessarily wear their intelligence like a badge.
Back in Dallas, Diane Tran just wears a hat with dozens of dinosaur pins on it.
This is a Baryonyx. There's the Mosasaur, which is what this presentation is about.
Tran says she's loved paleontology for decades and was so excited about the lecture that she brought some friends. She says they liked it, and so did she.
I thought it was great. Learned some things I didn't know. This is much more intimate, and I enjoyed it.
Tran, like many here, heard about this on Facebook. Schmidt says success of Profs and Pints will depend in part on the affordable advertising available through social media. In this case, he used words like dinosaur and paleontology while targeting users within 10 miles of Dallas.
So I'm really trolling through waters where I know I'll find the fish I'm trying to catch.
Tonight's catch? About 40 people. Not bad, says Schmidt, for his second Profs and Pints presentation in Dallas. It covered his cost for the professor, but he says he's got more work to do to keep this venture from going the way of the mosasaurs. I'm Bill Zeebel for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. When the sun comes up on a sleepy little town 90 miles east of San Antone, it illuminates three new billboards bearing what some in that town might consider to be a somewhat menacing message. According to those billboards, there's a new Bach in Shiner. Oh, come on. What's so menacing about that? After all, Shiner, Texas has long been famous for its Bach, right? Shiner Bach is probably the best-known beer from the town's 110-year-old Spetzel Brewery. Problem is, the billboards in question here were not put up by the Spetzel Brewery. And some in Shiner are not very happy about the competition nosing in this way on their hallowed ground. Aaron Douglas, who's covering this story for the Houston Chronicle, joins us now on the Texas Standard. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how did Shiner respond to the billboards? These went up, and what did townsfolk say?
Well, Shiner decided to respond with a marketing response of their own, and they published an open letter in the local newspaper that they also published on social media last week. It was an aggressive response to an aggressive marketing scheme that they were that they felt that they were under attack by. So, you know, it said, come and take it. This is our town. We've had big companies try to take market share before, and we're not going to back down. It was very Texas battle style, and that has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of folks commenting and supporting, and it's really blown up among the craft brewery scene.
Let's back up just a bit. Who put up these three billboards?
So that is a little bit of a dispute here. So Carbach Brewing, which is a Houston brewer that was recently bought by Anheuser-Busch, they decided to sponsor a music festival in Shiner, Texas.
Hmm.
And they partnered with their distributor, Del Papa Distributing, in Shiner, Texas. And Carbach, according to a statement, says that the distributor, not Carbach, created these advertisements. However, they did decide to sponsor the music festival in Shiner.
This isn't, I mean, just a rivalry for rivalry's sake. We're talking about a specific kind of beer in the first place, right? I mean, how does the Bach play into all this?
Right, right. So the Bock beer, which is a strong dark lager, the market for Bock beers is relatively small, according to the Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. However, within that niche market, Shiner Bock represents about 93%
wow.
of sales over the last year. So, you know, they've had complete domination over this very niche market for a long time. And there have been various iterations of Bocks that have tried to compete. Carbox Brewing latest beer, Crawford Brock, is the latest iteration of that competitor.
Yeah, I've seen some of the Crawford Bock six packs, and they're playing big on Texas and in particular Houston, sort of Astros style, you know, colors.
Yeah, yeah, and it actually supports the Astros Foundation, the Astros charity.
Yeah. How much of this is about the difference in size between these two breweries, too? Because you have this old brewery, the Spetzel Brewery, that has a whole lot of history. Carbock used to be this independent Houston-based brewery, now owned by one of the biggest corporate brewers in existence, Anheuser-Busch InBev, right?
Right. And the craft brewing scene has obviously exploded in recent years and now claims about 24% of the U.S. market for beer. However, you know, compared to some of these bigger players, it's really no competition. And so I think that is one reason why people are so upset about this incident, because they view Carbock as being a brewer that has now been bought by one of these giants in the industry and is coming in and sort of attacking a smaller craft brewer. That being said, Shiner is a pretty big craft brewer. It's the largest craft brewery in Texas. It's one of the largest craft breweries in the U.S. But it does sort of bring up this question of what happens when a big company like Anheuser-Busch buys a craft brewer and keeps that name and continues branding, you know, with that same craft brewery image.
So the Battle of the Bocks is underway in Shiner, Texas, no less. Erin Douglas is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and we'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Erin, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. A preventative regimen, including a healthy diet and exercise, can help prevent lung cancer. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. The Austin City Council could approve an $8 million plan this week to buy a South Austin motel and convert it into housing for up to 80 people transitioning out of homelessness. Mayor Steve Adler says the plan focuses more on long-term housing solutions, not short-term ones.
I'm encouraged that the city's actually going to be now turning the corner and getting on the path of providing a greater number of housing opportunities for that community, because that's the only way that you ultimately solve this challenge.
A nonprofit coalition announced a plan last week for a privately funded shelter in the downtown area. Governor Greg Abbott says he will set aside 5 acres of state land for a temporary shelter. Access to an area in the Eagle Ford Shale remains restricted more than a week after a natural gas well blowout. KUT's Becky Fogle has the latest.
Devon Energy and its contractors were able to seal off the well this past weekend. It was spewing natural gas and other pollutants into the air since November 1st. A spokesperson for the company says they are working closely with local and state authorities on public safety issues. While there have been no injuries, several homes in the immediate area of the accident were evacuated. Devon Energy is providing lodging and meals to the people affected. Assessment of environmental cleanup requirements is also underway. I'm Becky Fogle in Austin.
Residents in the West Texas border town of Presidio could soon see a new kind of traffic crossing through the local port of entry. Caravans of Central American citizens, known as transmigrantes, who make a living towing junk cars from the U.S. to their home countries, where they sell them for a profit. Marfa Public Radio's Sally Beauvais reports local officials say the Mexican government is behind the potential change.
Currently, the only approved route from the U.S. into Mexico for transmigrantes runs through Los Indios, a small town in South Texas. But Mexican officials are considering diverting a percentage or all of that traffic through Presidio. That's according to City Administrator Jose Portillo. At a recent county meeting, he said he's still waiting on official word from the Mexican government. He cited criminal activity along the current route through Mexico as one of the motivating factors behind the change.
To have all those vehicles parked all over the place, if we don't regulate this, then it would be a concern. I could see where it could affect the quality of life.
According to Portillo, over 100,000 transmigrantes passed through Los Indios in fiscal year 2018. Presidio officials are scrambling to come up with a plan to accommodate the potential jump in traffic, which Portillo says could happen as early as January 2020.
Sally Bove reporting from West Texas. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Medical Center's Dr. Tim Garson and Ryan Holywell, authors of Exposing the 20 Medical Myths, Why Everything You Know About Healthcare is Wrong and How to Make It Right, available on Amazon.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. By now, you probably heard that the nation is facing a looming shortage of doctors. Well, now hear this. The doctor shortage may not be true. A new Texas Medical Center survey upends a whole lot of conventional wisdom, not the least of which is the perceived certainty of a physician shortage. Okay, so what's really the state of the healthcare industry, and who are we supposed to believe? Jenny Deem is healthcare reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jenny, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
It's my understanding that the Association of American Medical Colleges has predicted we could be short more than 120,000 doctors by the next decade. What is this new survey telling us about that looming shortage?
Well, I think the survey is fascinating. And to be fair, it is not actually saying that there won't be shortages, that there won't be parts of the country that are underserved. What this survey did, when you really dig into the responses, is that the doctors themselves aren't sure, and they just don't know whether this is going to happen or not. And what makes that fascinating is that this idea of a physician shortage crisis has been repeated over and over again, both within the medical community, certainly within the news media. I know I've written stories about it. And, you know, this is the basis of building new medical schools. It's just become fact. And what was fascinating to me in this survey, well, while the doctors themselves say, sure, we think it could happen, we're going to prepare for it. If you look further down, you know, when you ask them, how sure are you? They say, well, we're not. we're not sure. So that kind of calls into question that perhaps some of this has been overstated. And I thought it was fascinating that Vivian Ho, who is a noted health economist, agrees and says that she thinks there may be a little bit of overpanic.
Well, let's pull back for a moment so that we understand just what this survey is, because no one can no one can really see into the future. But what this is doing is this Texas Medical Center survey is asking 2,000 consumers, you write, and 750 doctors. We're talking about both primary care physicians and specialists, a whole wide array of questions. But when you put the answers together, you start to see some interesting things. Like, for instance, when people are asked, do you have any trouble getting an appointment? Which might be an important indicator of when it comes to a doctor shortage or something looming. What do they say?
They said no. And this was also a little bit of a counterintuitive. It said that new patients' visits to a primary care, only 19% of consumers said they had trouble getting an appointment in the last 12 months. That's for a primary care. For a specialist, only 15% said they had trouble in the last 12 months. And the other thing that's really interesting is that the respondents are split between urban and rural, and the urban patients actually had more trouble getting appointments than the rural patients.
Now, let's stop right there. The urban patients had more trouble than rural patients.
That's what the survey shows, yes.
Okay, but wait, talk about upending conventional wisdom. I have heard for some time now that, what is it, something like 24 counties in Texas have only one physician. I mean,
some counties have none. Yes, exactly. So that part definitely needs to be looked at a little clearer. One reason for the urban split is there's been some speculation that's an insurance issue, that people in urban areas don't have insurance, and so that may be why they're not getting those. But I think in the rural areas, I thought that's a fascinating thing that deserves more study. One thing that may have helped is telemedicine, and that is particularly important in rural areas like in Texas. And also perhaps the rise of nurse practitioners.
So what do you think the takeaway is here?
Well, I think the takeaway is that this bears a lot more study. I think that we as the public have accepted that there's going to be a doctor shortage, and there very well may be. But there may be some solutions. And it may be that we need to be more aware, and researchers need to look at this a little closer.
Jenny Dean at the Houston Chronicle will link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texans who live along the Gulf Coast have been through a lot in the past few years. Many lost cherished possessions, their homes, and to some extent a belief that they can ever be made whole again. But as Houston Public Media's Gail DeLauder discovered, a Houston area lawmaker appears to see something of a silver lining in all this, taking recent lessons learned and perhaps making changes to the system.
It's been a long 2 years for many people who suffered losses when Harvey flooded Houston. And then came another flood from Tropical Storm Imelda. But why are people having to wait so long to get help from the federal government?
That's a great question, and I have not gotten a great answer.
That's a question for a congresswoman from West Houston, one of the places that took the brunt of Harvey's floods.
I'm Lizzie Fletcher, and I am home for a district work period.
Democrat Lizzie Fletcher was elected last year to represent the 7th Congressional District, after defeating longtime Republican incumbent John Culberson. Much of her first year in office has been spent working with constituents who are still recovering, along with local governments that are seeking funds for flood control projects. Fletcher says the first bill she introduced in Congress is something called the HELP Act.
For example, there are projects that the city had identified, or Harris County Flood Control had identified, that they wanted to do. But if they started the project, it would be considered a project in progress and ineligible for FEMA funding. So they put in applications 2 years ago for certain projects like the Inwood Golf Course project and some of the other projects that have now been approved, but that process took 2 years. So the HELP Act that I offered, which is a bipartisan bill, I've got a good coalition of folks from Texas and across the country supporting it, that bill cuts some of that red tape, makes it easier for cities and local sponsors to begin projects without jeopardizing their ability to get those FEMA funds.
Those are the problems local governments face. But what about the individual homeowners? Along with everything else they have to deal with, they often have to battle multiple bureaucracies to get some relief.
And it's not centered around the victim. It's really centered around these different agencies. So you go to FEMA, and then you go to the Small Business Administration, and then you go to HUD potentially for some of the HUD funding. And that comes through the city and the county, but it may also come from the GLO. And so there's so many different places. It would be helpful to think about this from the perspective of someone whose home has flooded or been destroyed by a fire. I mean, whatever the disaster is, let's think about this from that vantage point and make it an easier process. And I think that there are opportunities to do that, but it really takes working together and figuring out how can we focus on what Americans need to recover from disasters and approach it from that perspective instead of from the agency perspective. And that is something we are talking about in Congress. It's the question I asked the FEMA administrators just the other day. And we are committed to working on that and making it better for folks who have been affected to navigate the process. And I welcome suggestions and input from anyone who's been through that process on how we can improve it, because I do think having to go to so many different agencies is a real challenge. And when you're in an emergency, when you maybe don't have your records in front of you or you don't have your internet access and you're trying to keep your cell phone going, you just want to get as quickly as possible the right information. But over time, you need that process over the months and years that may take to recover. You need that process to be simplified and streamlined.
Fletcher's proposed HELP Act is still awaiting a House vote. I'm Gail DeLauder in Houston.
A large and continually growing body of research suggests that domestic violence is part of a larger dynamic of control and oppression in relationships. That law enforcement needs to be sensitive to how abusers use coercion, intimidation, emotional, and economic abuse to create a cycle that traps and punishes many partners. But a recent report suggests the military hasn't been getting the message. It cites the mishandling of cases, fewer prosecutions, and ongoing dangers for many of those who report abuse. For the American Homefront Project, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports some abused spouses say they're not taken seriously by military investigators.
Elise Monroe remembers her ex-husband's anger, quick, explosive, and loud.
He liked to punch things. One night when he was drunk and angry, he punched a hole in our shower. It was always my fault. If he was angry, it was something I did.
But Monroe says the first time she felt fear was in January 2010, a few months after she, her husband, and their two young children moved on base at Fort Drum, New York.
And I remember that night I had tried to lock myself in our bedroom, and he kicked it open and cornered me. And I had tripped and fallen, and he grabbed me really hard on the arm and picked me up.
When military police showed up, they noted the torn apart house and the bruises that had started to bloom on Monroe's arms. They took her husband away for a 72-hour cool down period and sent Monroe to have her injuries photographed at a base medical facility. But while the Army punished Monroe's husband for damaging their house, he was never prosecuted for hurting her. Instead, his command ordered him to go to anger management counseling. Monroe says no one followed up about her well-being.
No one offered me services. No one told me that there were things that were there for me, for my benefit, for my children's benefit. In my opinion, it was solely concentrated on him.
Monroe's situation is not unique. Earlier this year, the Defense Department Inspector General found that the military often mishandles domestic violence. It said military police sometimes were sloppy with evidence collection and interviewing, and often failed to report offenses into federal databases as required. The Inspector General also found that police often didn't tell abused spouses about family advocacy, a Defense Department program which offers them support and safety counseling. Lisa Colella directs Healing Household 6, a military family organization.
You know, certainly people come to me and they show me evidence that they have reported in the way that they're supposed to. And there have been more times than I can count that the family advocacy representative told me that they didn't have any file on this person.
The report also found commanders sometimes interfered at crime scenes, pushing law enforcement to do things that weren't in keeping with protocol. And Colella says an abuser's command sits on the committee that decides what's actually violence.
It's just this giant, like, jumbled mess of reputations and culture and who's the service member and how many medals do they have and what have they done and was this really abuse?
Since the IG report was released in April, Colella says she's seen signs that some bases have begun to take their domestic violence protocols more seriously, though the response has been inconsistent. Another change happened last year when Congress amended the military's criminal code to include domestic violence. Brian Club of the Battered Women's Justice Project says that may be encouraging enforcement.
What Congress directed was that now, with the specific domestic violence and domestic assault offense, it would be easier to track these offenses within the military justice system, be able to report on them, as well as to be able to flag them correctly for civilian law enforcement.
But for domestic abuse survivor Elise Monroe, change didn't come fast enough. Her ex-husband's violence continued to escalate until 2016, when, after leaving the service, he threatened her life.
There was a moment where he had me on the front step with his knee in my side, and he had punched me in the face and said that if I was not quiet, he was going to put me in the ground where I belonged. I knew he had a loaded weapon in his truck.
Monroe fled with her kids to safety and is now remarried. Her ex-husband continued to spiral. Last year, he was shot by a guard at the Department of Veterans Affairs after he threatened the guard with a knife. He survived the shooting but was convicted of several crimes. Monroe can't help but wonder if that all could have been prevented if the military had taken her abuse more seriously. This is Carson Frame reporting.
The American Homefront Project is a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Here's a question you won't hear very often. What do Ted Cruz and Kim Kardashian have in common? Both have Twitter accounts, you say? Well, you'd only be half right. Both Cruz and Kardashian are among those using social media to publicly urge the state of Texas to reconsider the November 20th scheduled execution of Rodney Reed. On Friday, the Republican senator and supporter of capital punishment joined Kardashian, Oprah Winfrey, and a fast-growing group of bipartisan lawmakers and celebrities, urging officials to take a closer look at Reed's case. Over the weekend, hundreds of people rallied on Reed's behalf outside the Texas governor's mansion. But Reed's been on death row for murder for 2 decades. Why the sudden interest in his case, and will it make any difference? Joining us now is reporter Jolie McCullough. She covers criminal justice for the Texas Tribune. Jolie, welcome back to the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this case getting so much attention all of a sudden?
Well, this case has been pretty high profile in Texas for decades, since Rodney Reed was convicted in 1998. But it's gotten a lot of attention nationwide now because his execution date is nearing, and some celebrities like Kim Kardashian, who are also criminal justice reform advocates, have really picked this up and have made this. They've been talking about it at award shows. It spread to a lot of the Democratic presidential candidates. So it's really getting a lot of attention nationwide.
Let's just be clear for those who have not been following this story closely. Reed is an African-American man who was convicted in the death of a white woman in Bastrop County. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Rodney Reed was convicted in the 1996 killing of a 19-year-old white woman, Stacy Stites. There has been a lot of people who have pointed to Stacy's fiance, who has also since been convicted and sentenced in a rape case. So there's a lot of questions that have come forward with this based on new evidence that claims this could have been a consensual sex with Rodney, versus there's this now a lot of new evidence against the character of her fiance.
The theory, I suppose, being that there might have been some kind of jealousy motive, although that certainly hasn't been established, nor has her ex-fiance been indicted or charged in the crime.
Correct.
This is, just to be clear about this, this is not Reed's first execution date, right?
No, he has had another execution date that was also, it was stayed by the courts, and he still has some appeals pending in the courts. He got a new hearing in 2017 where they went over for 4 days of some of the new evidence that they claim that they're talking about now, and it was denied ultimately. So there are still some appeals going on in the courts about DNA testing, about the new evidence, these new witnesses who have come forward, one of whom is someone who was in prison with Stacy's fiance, who claims that her fiance admitted to killing her. But a lot of the attention has turned to Governor Greg Abbott, who has, with the parole board, authority to stop this execution for an extended period of time, since there have been 2 decades now of court action where they have ultimately failed up to this point.
You know, it's one thing for Kim Kardashian or Oprah Winfrey to weigh in on this matter. But now that Senator Ted Cruz is, and he's well known to be a supporter of capital punishment, is weighing in apparently on Reed's behalf. How does that, or does that, change the picture here?
Well, I think the fact that there have been large amount of Republican lawmakers coming forward asking for the governor to allow more time for review of this case is very telling. There was letters sent by 26 House members, 13 of whom are Republicans, as well as 16 senators, 8 of whom are Republicans, in the Texas legislature on top of that sent this before Ted Cruz. And so there is a showing that there's a large bipartisan support for to take a step back and take another look at this.
Any evidence that the governor is listening to the protests or reading the tweets, paying any attention to the mounting protests over his impending execution?
Well, his office hasn't said anything publicly. I think it would be impossible for him to not have been paying attention to this. They're on his steps, and it's been, you know, calls have been coming from all over the country. I'm sure it's on his radar. It's unclear what effect that is having on him at the moment.
Jolie McCullough is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Jolie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. So what are Texans talking about on this Tuesday?
Hi, David. Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, as we just heard the big social media outcry about the impending execution of Rodney Reed, many people chiming in about this story on our Facebook page. Jen Wireman there, she says, "When I find myself agreeing with Ted Cruz, you know this is serious," referring there, as we just heard, to the sort of, I guess you could say, strange bedfellows or this bipartisan coalition increasingly raising some doubts about carrying forward with the execution as planned. Another listener, Janice, calls herself 100% pro-death penalty for people who have been demonstrated to be guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. However, she says there is plenty of reasonable doubt in this case. There is zero excuse that they are not examining the DNA and other potentially exculpatory evidence. So again, people chiming in on this case.
This is a case that's been talked about, at least here in Texas, for some time. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's getting national attention, sort of suggests. It'll be interesting to see how the governor ultimately responds, mm-hmm. or if the governor ultimately responds. Yeah. I don't know that he's acknowledged.
Listening to the conversation, yeah, a very active participant on social media. We have yet to see the governor weigh in there. Well, shifting gears, another story on social media people are talking about. I think you know which one I'm talking about. The weather, as temperatures plummeted all across the state.
My
due
hands
to that blast
are still
of Arctic
cold
wind.
From this morning,
man,
dude.
I mean, moisturize. I really got to moisturize,
yeah,
man. I'm just saying, you know, fellas out there, don't let it pass you by. Keep your hands moisturized. Yeah. Mandy Wagoner Ray, this is nice. We're getting a little roundup of the conditions from around the state via Facebook and Twitter. Mandy Wagoner Ray, she says that we started the school day at 15 degrees. It's warmed up to a balmy 30 here in Amarillo. Denise Crediden says in Seguin, it's 33 degrees. And last night it was so windy, there is stuff everywhere this morning. Trish Morton says 29 and sunny in Fort Worth. Love it. While our pal Jaime Solorza says it's 39 in El Paso, but the wind chill, 33 degrees. And yeah, that mountain wind there in El Paso, that mountain desert wind, I tell you, gets you every time.
Yeah.
You know, everything is relative, as our friend Nebraska Bobbert tweets us. He says his friends in Nebraska, where it's between under -5 and 3 degrees, are sarcastically praying for me and hoping I make it out okay when I post on social media that we have a 2-hour late start because it's 32 degrees. And yeah, always makes for an interesting traffic morning with the late start there in the school districts. That was the case here in Central Texas this morning. It seems like there's widely reported two-hour late starts.
This is shades of when you have one of these things where the entire grocery store clears out, loses all the bread.
All the bread and milk.
Because there's like a 20% chance of light sleet that won't even stay on the ground. So, you know, it's just one of those things. Texas things, y'all. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we'd love to hear your reports on the weather or anything else making news in your part of Texas. Reach out to us, won't you, at Texas Standard. We're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us one way or the other. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.